A fisherman was lying along the banks on a river in Maine one day, just kind of lazily throwing his line into the water, and every so often he'd haul out a silver salmon. In between pulling out a fish, from time to time he would take a bite out of his homemade sandwich and a drink from his six-pack of beer that he had, and all in all, he thought, boy, this is really a wonderful afternoon. I'm having a really good time. As he was hauling in a fish, a businessman from one of the nearby towns, very prosperous-looking businessman, strolled over and said, you know, don't you realize that you could catch a lot more fish if you had several lines out there in the water at the same time? He said, well, why would I want more fish? Well, if you had more fish, you could sell more, you'd have more money, and you could buy a big fishing boat. Then, with that big fishing boat, you can catch more fish, and you can open up a store and sell your fish to the whole town rather than just have fish for yourself. After you opened one store, you could open a second store, and soon you could open a third store. Then you'd have many people working for you, and eventually you'd be so big and so successful you could be have a wholesale fish market, and you'd become a very rich man shipping your fish all over America. The fisherman took a swig of beer, looking unconvinced, and he said, well, then what would I do? Why, then you'd be successful, and you'd have all the time in the world to do whatever you most enjoy doing. Why, you could even be out here lying on your back, fishing and relaxing. The fisherman smiled, looked up at him, and said, but that's what I'm doing now. You know, that's sometimes what our lives mirror, just the opposite of what was happening there. Sam mentioned about enjoying our work and enjoying what we're doing. Instead of relaxing and doing something we enjoy, a lot of times we're like a hamster or a gerbil that's in one of these little treadmills that they exercise on. It goes around and around and around, and their little feet are more than a churning as they keep it going. They never get anywhere. They may get a lot of exercise, but they don't go anyplace. In an effort to get more, a lot of times we work harder, or we spend more time finding different methods to be more efficient, so that presumably we will end up having more. But that oftentimes will end up consuming a lot of our time and consequently take away much of the freedom that we enjoy. Unfortunately, that is a sad commentary about a lot of people who are driven to possess things. Now, I'm not suggesting that we just grab a fishing pole and go out and go fishing and head for the nearest lake whenever the feeling arises, especially if we have the responsibility of a family. You've probably heard the saying, the best things in life are free, which comes from a old popular song that was written back in 1927 by Ray Henderson. And the lyrics were by Buddy De Silva and Lou Brown. Over the years, it's become a standard. And I think in the 50s, there was even a movie with the title track, The Best Things in Life Are Free. Some of the lyrics go, the moon, the stars belong to everyone, the flowers in spring, the robins that sing, these things that you can enjoy and you don't have to pay anything for are what the meaning of the song was trying to get across. The best things in life are free. You don't spend a lot of money on them. They're just there for everyone to enjoy. Sometimes people find themselves in an untenable situation because in the drive to acquire more things, they may have to compromise their standards in order to get there. Turn to Luke 16. Luke 16, beginning in verse 1. I'm going to look at a parable that deals with this type of thing. Luke 16, verse 1. And Christ is talking here, and he said unto his disciples, there was a certain rich man which had a steward, and the same was accused unto him that he'd wasted his goods. It doesn't say exactly how they were wasted or what he had done. Was he skimming, or was he, as the saying goes, cooking the books? Was he falsifying the account or the accounts? Was he embezzling money? It doesn't really say specifically, but whatever he was doing was not right in verse 2. And so his boss called him and said unto him, how is it that I hear this of thee? You know, I hear all these rumors about how I'm losing money and that you're responsible for it. And I find I can't ignore it any longer. I want you to give me an account of your stewardship. I want you to bring your set of books, and I want to compare them with what I think they should say. But because of all these rumors, I'm not going to retain you in my employment. He said, for thou mayest be no longer steward. You know, the auditors have given me a report, and that doesn't dovetail with your accounting. So I need to see the proof. What is accurate? Which of these two sets of books are accurate? In verse 3, then the steward said within himself, what am I going to do? My boss is taking away from me the stewardship. I can't dig. I'm not used to physical labor. If I look at my hands, they're lily white. I'd have blisters the first day I tried doing something of a physical nature. And I'm too ashamed. I can't go out and stand by the freeway on the on-ramp and hold a sign that says hungry, out of work, or whatever the poor did back at that time. I can't do those things. You know, no one in town is going to hire me when the work or the word gets out. So verse 4, he said, you know, I think I know a way to solve this problem. I'm resolved what to do, that when I'm put out of the stewardship, they may receive me into their houses. So once I lose my job, he says, I'm going to find a way to cement relationships so I'm not just swinging out there by myself, that I have contacts, that I have a way to continue working. In verse 5, he said, "So he called every one of his Lord's debtors unto him and said unto the first, how much do you owe my boss? And he said, 100 measures of oil. And so he said unto him, take your bill and sit down quickly and write 50. And I'll tear up your IOU for 100 and replace it with the one that says 50, and you'll save 50. You know, thinking it'll help cover up the 50 I stole from my boss. And once again, it doesn't say how he did it, but this is what he was trying to do. He was trying to cover up what he had done, but also ingratiate himself and become friends with people that he thought would be able to help him when he was no longer there. Verse 7, then said he to another, and how much owest thou? And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said unto him, take thy bill and write 80 or 80. So if you understand what he was doing here, and it said he called all of his debtors, so he went through each one of the IOUs and somehow, depending upon whatever formula he used to arrive at the figures, he discounted them by having them rewrite what they owed and then presumably tore up the original. So if you think about what they were doing, everyone was a participant in this crime that was taking place. They all became accomplices because they went along with it. It was beneficial to them. So they were just as much at fault, in a sense, as the steward. Verse 8, continuing on. And here's something that looks very strange on the surface when you read it. And when the Lord, or his boss, heard about it, he commended the unjust steward. You know, you would think he'd be reprimanded, severely reprimanded, because he was losing out here. Although, at this point, when he found out what had happened, perhaps there was a way that he could rectify the situation by proving that the steward had, you know, falsified the records. But he commended the unjust steward because he'd done wisely. For the children of this world are in their generation wiser than the children of light. So he said, you know, you did what you had to do, and it was pretty smart. You know, when I think about it, I might pull something like that myself sometime with some of the people I deal with. By doing what he did, the steward had a favorable connection with the people in the town. He knew, you know, maybe they'd be so grateful to him that they would give him a job so his lily white hands wouldn't get blisters, and he would still be respected by a group of people who were used to shady business practices and didn't think there was anything wrong with what he'd done. You know, they may have said, well, that's, you know, if you can get away with it, more power to you. And there are probably people like that. You know, that's the way they do business. And they'd probably just say, well, you know, business is business. If you can find a way to make a buck, more power to you. But Jesus said in verse 9, continuing on, he said, I say unto you, make to yourselves friends of the mammon of unrighteousness. Notice it doesn't say that you become unrighteous, but that you use your money wisely. He's not condoning unrighteousness. So use your money wisely so when you fail or quit, they may receive you into everlasting and Strong's the description of what everlasting means here is G166. It means eternal, without beginning or end. Habitations, eternal habitations. So in this example, Christ showed that the unconverted are generally wiser than the converted, and that we who are converted can correct this inequality by using our money wisely. Not that we use it in an illegal manner or we choose a life of crime, but that we use it in doing good works in the world so that the people who may become converted by our contributions will one day welcome us and one day thank us for the money we contributed, which perhaps ended up leading to their conversion. Maybe they'll see something different in us, the way we act, the way we conduct ourselves, that will provoke a change in them, so that someday they'll be one of our brothers or one of our sisters sharing habitations alongside of us in the kingdom of God together. In conjunction with this, there's something specific we can address that will help us immensely. As a preface, I'm going to read something that I read a number of years ago that described an average or typical day in our lives. Today, my heart beat 105,389 times. My blood traveled 168,000 miles. I breathed 23,000 times, inhaled 438 cubic feet of air. I spoke 4,800 words, and Veronica would say, you better reduce that to 480, and maybe even 48, depending upon what the day was like. Moved 750 muscles, exercise 7 million brain cells. Whoa, I'm tired. Exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point. You know, all of these things are involuntary, and for the most part, we seldom even think about them. You know, it's human to take all of these things for granted. I doubt if we sit or stand at work and consciously think about our blood or about the intricate piece of machinery that is our body until something goes wrong with it. Because of the media, we seem to be geared to or centered on material things. We need to be thankful for what we have and not take it for granted. For example, our body. And all of us have varying degrees of health, good or bad. So it's an individual thing. But even then, you shouldn't take that body for granted. During the last several minutes, you've breathed approximately 10 times. You know, it was all involuntary on your part. You weren't sitting there consciously thinking about what you were doing. If you knew you were going to be deprived of that air, you know what would happen to you after a period of time. You know, one picture is worth a thousand words, so I'm going to demonstrate something. I would like you to hold your breath for 30 seconds, and while I've got a timer up here, And when I count down, you know, one, two, three, then you can, I'll tell you, hold your breath. I'd like you to hold it for 30 seconds, unless you have a physical problem of some kind that, you know, would preclude you doing that. I don't want, you know, a number of 9/11 calls on my record here for speaking, for putting someone on the floor. So if you're able to, let me qualify it that there's no, you don't get anything for doing it or not doing it. It's just to demonstrate something. So I will count to three, and those of you who can, hold your breath. One, two, three, hold it. If you were an announcer on a radio station, this is what is called dead air. And if you have too many times this happens while you're broadcasting or announcing, you'll be out of a job. And if you listen to the radio, you will notice it's pretty rapid fire. There's not a whole lot of gaps. Okay. I think I let it go a little too long. You did well, but how sweet. 1 second. Oh, 1 minute? Okay, well, I told you we need a light up here. Anyway, how sweet does that air smell, those of you who are still living and breathing? Well, let me ask you a question regarding that. When was the last time you thanked God for your air? You know, we need to be thankful for the things that we have and not unthankful for the things we don't have. A number of years ago, I read a book by Robert Mueller entitled Most of All, They Taught Me Happiness. He was a young man who fought in the French resistance during World War II, and he was captured and imprisoned. And this book, along with a number of other things, describes some of the things that he faced in captivity. He said that 30 men were standing in a cell meant to hold six. They took a cell, and actually it originally was meant to hold only two, but four to six could be in that cell if they were all standing. But there were 30 in that particular cell that he was in. And he said it was like being in a subway in Tokyo or New York City. And in Tokyo, you've probably seen pictures of people outside that are pushing, you know, to get the passengers in as many, to get as many in as they can. It was like that. And they didn't talk in order to save oxygen. And he said the stench was overpowering from the one bucket that was in the room in the corner to collect human waste. Every morning they were allowed to walk in the courtyard to empty that bucket and for a brief time be able to breathe that fresh, crystal clear, delightful air as he described it. Now, you can't imagine that unless you actually experience something like that. He found there was a small peephole in the door to the cell, and when he got up near it, he could feel a fresh stream or a stream of fresh air coming in. So he always positioned himself in front of that door while he was in that cell, and that's how he was able to survive. Well, as I said before, when was the last time you thanked God for the air you breathe? We need to be thankful for everything that we have, and conversely, not unthankful for what we don't have. You know, it would be interesting to know how many of our problems arise because we are not thankful. Turn to James 1, verse 17. James 1, verse 17. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above. I don't remember which automobile manufacturer it was, but sometime within the last several years, this one company recalled a large number of cars because some of them had developed problems. I've forgotten, you know, what part of the car it was, but it led to a number of deaths because of what happened. I don't know if they caught on fire or what it was, but it was, you know, something that caused them to have to recall them. God does not recall his gifts to us. Every gift that he gives us is good, and every gift he gives us is perfect. And as it says here, and cometh down from the Father of lights, with which or with whom is no variableness. He doesn't vacillate back and forth. He doesn't give you something that's good and then give you something that's bad and then take the good one back. Neither shadow of turning. That's not the way he is. He's consistent. He's loving. And when he gives you something, it's something that he knows is good, will be good for you. If you get something that's not good for you, don't assume that God gave it to you. He only gives you what is good. Turn to Psalms 84, verse 11. Psalm 84, verse 11. For the eternal God is a sun and shield. The eternal will give grace and glory. No good thing will he withhold from them. And here's what we have to do, that walk uprightly. So there is a condition. Is that how your life is being lived? Is that how my life is being lived? Is that how our lives are being lived? Are we walking uprightly? You know, are we to the best of our knowledge walking uprightly? Of course we make mistakes. You know, that happens all the time. But are we continuing to head in a certain direction? Are we not just intentionally deviating away from that? Maybe we have a slight disagreement with God's definition of good. You know, he says fresh air is good. We say a black Maserati Gran Turismo Sport with an air conditioner is better, with a price tag of $135,000, give or take $1,000 or so. You know, God says carrots are good. We say Chateaubriand with Béarnaise sauce, white wine, mushrooms, shallots mixed with butter, tarragon, and lemon juice. That's even better. And usually that's reserved for most of us at the feast or one of the holy days. God says a cold, frosty, clear glass of cold water is good. We say a case of champagne is better. Now, I know the examples I've used are not identical to the way we think. I don't at least think there's anyone in here that think or has thought about those examples, but it illustrates a point. You know, some women might say, and I don't think it applies to anyone in this room, that 20 or 30 dresses are good. And God says, one black, long-sleeved, buttoned at the neck like the Amish wear is better. I just, no tomatoes, I just threw that in to see if you're still with me or if still awake. You know, I think we all know there are dresses that are very attractive, very tasteful, and modest without revealing all of the human anatomy, as are found with some styles. You know, I think all of us appreciate color and variety, but I doubt that there are many women in this room that can afford to wear a dress only once or twice. You know, let's reserve that for the Hollywood types. Although Madison Avenue is doing its very best with its advertising campaign to try to condition us to think that way. We need to be thankful for what we have and not unthankful for what we don't have. Turn to Luke 17, verse 12. Luke 17, verse 12. Talking about Jesus here. And as he entered into a certain village, there met him 10 men that were lepers, which stood afar off. And they lifted up their voices and said, Jesus, Master, have mercy on us. And when he saw them, he said unto them, go, show yourselves unto the priests. And it came to pass that as they went, they were cleansed. So they followed his instructions. It didn't seem like it was, you know, a very big thing, but they did follow his instructions, and as a result, they were all healed. Verse 15. And in verse 15, and one of them, when he saw that he was healed, turned back and with a loud voice glorified God and fell down on his face at his feet, giving him thanks. And he was a Samaritan. Now, you don't have to turn there. I'm just going to read John 4, verse 9, where Jesus was talking to the women or the woman at the well. And he said, or then saith the woman of Samaria unto him, how is it that thou, being a Jew, askest drink of me, which am a woman of Samaria? For the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. You know, the Samaritans were outcasts. You remember the, you know, the example in the parable of the Good Samaritan. Here was one that was good, presumably, because of what he did, taking care of the man who had been robbed and beaten and left by the wayside. So the Samaritan, you know, there was no love lost between the Jews and the Samaritans. Verse 17, and Jesus answering said, were there not 10 cleansed? But where are the 9? There are not found that return to give glory to God, save this stranger. So, you know, even there he was including him. The Samaritans were strangers. They weren't people that you spent time with. Verse 19, and he said unto him, arise, go thy way. Thy faith hath made thee whole. We need to be thankful for what we have, what we get. and not unthankful for what we don't have. Don't take this life for granted. You know, you're never going to be able to obtain everything you want, but you will always be blessed with so much more if you are looking to God to provide it for you. And we have already seen that when I read nothing comes from God unless it's good. Regardless of the situation you may find yourself in right today, right now, all you have to do is look around and you'll always find or see someone that has less or has something far worse than you have. That's just the way life is. Make a habit each day to single out and think about a different blessing. I mean, consciously do it. Don't just blow it off and forget about it. Think of a blessing that you enjoy, that you have. It may have no meaning or relevance to anyone else in this room, but that's unimportant. You pick out what is important to you, what personally is important to you. You know, one day, for example, you may think about what it's like to have two eyes. You know, even if you have to use glasses to see, you still have the use of those eyes, so that doesn't matter. Some of us were reminiscing a little while back about a deceased member of the church by the name of Chuck McFarlane, and a few of you remember him. He lost the sight of both of his eyes in the Second World War, and also lost one of his hands, which was replaced by this prosthesis that had a hook on it. It looked like a hook, but with which he was able to do amazing things. It was absolutely amazing. One time his wife, Tina, was having trouble parallel parking between two cars. And after numerous attempts, Chuck began to get a little exasperated and finally told her, "Move over." He was totally blind, but he got behind the wheel and he parked that car on the first attempt. Now, she, you know, was there to tell him where he was in relation to the cars, because obviously couldn't see that. You know, he may not have been able to see the flowers or the stars or the animals or the streams out where he lived. And they lived in a beautiful place out east of Monroe, up in the mountains. And he actually had built the house up there pretty much by himself with the help of Tina. He had his senses so honed that they were more acute than probably most of us. He probably was able to see things and hear things that we wouldn't feel in the same way. Another day, you know, when we eat, try to consciously think of the homeless and the hungry. Right here in the Puget Sound area. If you've been watching the news, you probably know the city of Seattle has trying to, in a series of very controversial meetings, trying to come up with a tax that will raise money to take care of the homeless by, you know, taxing some of the major businesses. For the benefit of the myriad of homeless people that we have in this area. You know, when we go to school or when we go to work, do we ever think of those who still go hungry or have no place to live in our area? Now, admittedly, you know, there's a fine line of demarcation between those who are have a legitimate need and some that are freeloading. I recognize that. I understand that. A number of years ago, I read about the pouring of water in Japan as being a ceremony. You know, I don't remember the details about it or what it pertained to, but how many of us listen to the gurgling noise of water every time we turn the faucet on at home or any place? You may say, we've been listening to it on our roof for the last 6 months. What are you talking about? We know what it's like, you know, when we take a shower or run water in our sinks. Do we ever actually listen to the sound of it? You know, we're so acclimated to hearing that sound every day that we don't pay any attention to it. You know, tonight, why don't you just go home and turn on the faucet and just consciously think, you know, it's there. I take it for granted. As you know, the Barrens are heading south to Arizona. You know, but one of these days when the newness is worn off, I would bet you, if I were a betting man, that when they come back, and this will be on their honor to confess it one way or the other, that it's true or not, I think Tom and Louise know me well enough to, I can say this without fear of reprisal, that they will miss that rain that we take for granted and that we grumble about and that we groan about. And we look at these green trees out here and take for granted, and that's why they're there, because of that water. Anyway, remember that some of these very basic elements in our lives are the things that we often take for granted. However, if we take the time to really consider them, we will realize that they're some of the best things that have been given us to enjoy. Think about the immense way they contribute to the quality and the beauty of our lifestyle here in the Pacific Northwest. We need to be thankful to God for what we have and not unthankful for what we don't have. We need to make sure that we don't take the good things that God gives us for granted. Always remember the example of the grateful leper, and not to be redundant, but more in the way of being emphatic. We need to be grateful for what we have and not ungrateful for what we don't have.